Good morning. It's good to be back together after a weekend of painting and scraping gum and whatnot. My wife and I had dated for about 2 years before we started talking seriously about what would come next. We were dating long distance. She was going to school in Texas, and I was in school out here. We started talking about getting married and kind of decided to move in that direction. We even had a rough timeline that took into account our graduation dates and starting jobs and all of that stuff. So because we talked about everything, when it came time to actually ask her to marry me, I had this problem of how to do so in a way that might actually be surprising, since I knew she was expecting it. So because we were long distance, she had planned a trip to come out here to California to visit me, and I took advantage of that to plan a surprise trip the weekend before that to surprise her in Texas. So I took a red-eye flight out there, and I'd arranged with a friend of hers to meet her at 2 p.m. at her house to take her shopping. But of course, instead of that friend showing up, I was there. And as soon as she saw me, she knew what was going on, and we went on our way, and we were engaged later that day. Later, she told me that she was happy to see me, but she actually had some mixed feelings because she was really looking forward to going shopping with her friend. So, you know, you try, but it doesn't always work. Yeah, something. Well, this morning we're continuing our series in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians called Between the Times. We've observed that these books refer to the return of Jesus more than most of the books in the New Testament. And it seems like the Apostle Paul has written these books to this young church, trying to help them figure out what it looks like to live in between two major events, the resurrection of Jesus on one hand and the return of Jesus on the other hand. So far, we've mostly been talking about the resurrection of Jesus. What does it mean to follow this Savior that has died and is risen? 2 weeks ago, prior to Beautiful Day, we started talking more about the return. Scott Grant preached on a passage that addressed the topic of what happens to people who have died prior to Jesus returning. So we explored that topic to some detail. And our passage for this week moves on to a related issue of what about people who are still alive when Jesus returns? What will that look like? What will the return of Jesus be like? Our passage this week is 1 Thessalonians 5. It's verses 1 through 11. It's on page 987 on the Bibles in your pews if you'd like to follow along. This passage is in some way a reference back to some words Jesus spoke earlier. Jesus had a lot to say about his own return. In Matthew 24, he told several stories about his coming back. And it seems like this passage of the Apostle Paul's is an exposition of those stories. They refer to the same images, a lot of the same themes. It's as if this is Paul trying to help us to understand what Jesus meant by his stories. And you can understand that for the early church, seeing Jesus come and die and rise again and then leave, there were a lot of questions about how Jesus was going to return. What did it mean that he was coming back? When was he coming back? Can we expect him? Can we plan for it? All sorts of questions. Well, Rachel knew that at some point soon I was going to propose to her. She just didn't know when. And so she was surprised but not shocked when I showed up. And that's a little bit of the attitude that the Apostle Paul seems to describe of how to think about Jesus's return. We know he is returning, we just don't know exactly when. And so we expect him with this kind of awareness of ambiguity at the same time. We will be surprised by the day. Honestly, this topic is one of the reasons I was most excited to preach the books of Thessalonians, because I don't think we know really well how to think about the return of Jesus. I suspect that many of us don't think about it all that often. I suspect that for most of us, it doesn't play a huge part of what it means to follow Jesus. But that's a really unique thing in terms of the history of Christianity. The early church thought all the time about Jesus coming back. For them, the fact that Jesus was returning was an integral part of what it meant to believe in Jesus. But I think for us, sometimes we can almost even forget that part. I think it's an underappreciated aspect of what it means to be a Christian for a lot of contemporary believers. We need to consider what it means that Jesus is returning. We need to figure out how we can anticipate it and look forward to it and live our lives aiming at that day. So let's see what the Apostle Paul gives the Thessalonians, how he encourages them, and what we can learn from it. We'll start by seeing how Paul introduces this topic. This is the first three verses of 1 Thessalonians 5. Now, concerning the times and the seasons, brothers, you have no need to have anything written to you. For you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. While people are saying there is peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them, as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. He begins by introducing this topic of the times and seasons. This is a phrase that Jesus used in the first chapter of Acts. Just before he left them, he said this in verse 7, "It is not for you to know times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority." And so this is the topic that the Apostle Paul wants to discuss. When is Jesus going to return? He refers as well to the day of the Lord. This is the ancient way of speaking of that moment in history when everything comes together. The prophets spoke of the day of the Lord as that time when God would intervene, when he would fix things. It was a day of judgment of evil, a day of destruction, but ultimately it was a day of justice, the day when God would set right what had been broken in his creation. The apostle says that this day will come like a thief in the night. That's a reference back to these stories that Jesus told. In Matthew 24, 43, Jesus said this, "Know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into." So Jesus says that Paul says, the day of the Lord comes like a thief in the night. It's a curious phrase because we're used to talking about the return of Jesus as a good thing. We're supposed to anticipate this. And yet there's nothing good about your house being broken into while you sleep. It's probably one of our greatest fears, right? The place that we think is protected, the place that we feel most at home, where we are supposed to be safe, for that place to be violated unexpectedly is scary. Just a few months ago, our high school intern, Jim Jacobs, and his wife were sleeping in their apartment, and something came through their window onto the floor of their bedroom. And they thought, oh, it was our cat, but they opened their eyes, and it was a man who had come into their apartment, and he was as surprised as they were, and he burst out the front door, and they didn't even realize what was happening until later, realized somebody broke in and then left because they were scared. But it's that shock of, this is supposed to be my home. What is it doing being violated? And that's the element that the apostle explores in this passage, this idea of being surprised and fearfully surprised. He talks about people walking around saying, there is peace and security. They're safe. They're comfortable. But in the midst of that, sudden destruction will come out of nowhere, and they won't be able to escape it. This phrase, peace and security, is actually a piece of Roman propaganda. This is what the Roman state would preach to her citizens and say, Rome offers you peace and security. The Roman historian Paterculus described the founding of the city as Rome as a day that brought peace and security. Contemporary scholars describe the goals of Rome as creating a golden age. And one of the three characteristics of the golden age was that they would enjoy peace and security. This was the language that was in circulation at the time. So when Paul talks about people walking around saying there is peace and security, he's describing people that trust that Rome is going to take care of them. People who believe the propaganda they are being fed, who are drinking the Kool-Aid, who are buying into the slogans, who trust in Rome, who think that because Rome is in charge, they're going to be safe. And then out of nowhere, destruction comes. It turns out they had misplaced their trust. Turns out they were hoping in something that wasn't worth hoping in. It's a grim picture, but it's not a threat, it's a warning. It's a warning to all those who would put their hope in something to make sure that what you put your hope in for peace and security is worth hoping for. If you expect Rome to bring in the golden age, you're going to be disappointed. Rome can't deliver. Don't pin your hopes on something that can't deliver. Avoid false hope. Turns out that today, people still talk about peace and security. It's still a phrase, it's still a desire that we long for. In 2009, President Obama gave a speech in Prague, declaring his intent to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. The webpage of the UN says that the United Nations came into being in 1945 following the devastation of the Second World War with one central mission, the maintenance of international peace and security. A few weeks ago, politicians in Israel met together with one goal, to discuss finding peace and security in their region. And just last week, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh gave a speech calling for peace and security in his area of the world. This is what people want. This is what we're looking for. Plenty of people promise it. Plenty of people say, follow me, do this, trust in this, and you will get peace. But what about us? Who do we look for to provide peace and security? What do we look at thinking that it's going to give us what we want? Do you think you're safe? Do you think you're protected? Others have observed that the United States has three major centers of industrial influence right now. New York, in some ways, is the center of the financial industry. Los Angeles is the center of the entertainment industry. And Silicon Valley, right around us, is the center of the technology industry. And you could argue that if there's one of those industries that is shaping more of the world at this point in history, it is technology. We are at ground zero of one of the most influential areas in the world. And what do people say about technology? What do they hope for from technology? Larry Page of Google claims that people are starving because there is no technology to solve the problem of food distribution. Mark Zuckerberg wrote in a paper that increasing internet access will create jobs, reduce poverty, and decrease child mortality. I found a recent company that has been founded called Technology Will Save Us. This is the world we live in. We believe, this area is convinced in a very deep way that technology is the answer. Technology will bring in the golden age. Think about how we've responded to the occurrences of police violence lately. What's the solution to that problem? Body cameras. Technology. Technology can solve racial tension and violence and anger. Can it? If the Thessalonians thought that Rome would bring them peace and security, our world is convinced that technology, among other things, will do that. But will it? Are we putting our hope in the right place? We all want to find peace, security. We're all longing for this. And we are living in a culture that tells us, that propagandizes to us, that there's one thing that will offer that. And we're affected by that message. It's hard not to believe that. It's hard not to get caught up in that, living in this area. But we need to remember that there is a day coming that will bring peace and security. But it is not the day that everybody has internet access or that all policemen wear body cameras. It is the day that Jesus Christ returns. The coming of Jesus Christ will bring peace and security to a world that desperately needs it. The day of the Lord. He will come. He will set things right. Only placing our hope in Jesus Christ will eventually pay off. We need to avoid false hope. Well, the passage begins by describing a category of people who will be surprised, shocked at this day that to them seems like it comes out of nowhere. But then the apostle moves on and says that the people he's writing to are actually in a different category. Listen to what he says in verses 4 through 8. "But you are not in darkness, brothers, for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light, children of the day. We are not of the night or of the darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation." But you, the apostle says, you, if you believe in Jesus, you are different. Jesus has told his followers that he is coming back. He has predicted over and over again that there will come a day when his return will bring justice. For us, we do not live in darkness. We are children of the light. We are children of the day. That's a powerful phrase. On the one hand, we don't have to fear the thief that breaks in at night because we live in the day. We live in the daytime. We are children of that period. But also we are children of the day, capital D, the day that Jesus returns. We are those people who live our lives toward that moment. Everything we do is oriented toward the end of history, the beginning of eternity, when Jesus will return. That is what defines us. If you believe in Jesus, you know that he is coming back. Our entire lives are oriented in that direction. We aren't surprised by it. We're looking forward to it. We live toward the day. But what does that look like for us? How do we do that? What does it mean as we deal with jobs and classes and relationships? What does living toward the day look like? Well, the apostle uses two primary images. He says to stay awake and to be sober. These are also the dominant images from the stories that Jesus told in Matthew 24. We already talked about the story he told involving the master who would stay awake if he knew what time the thief was coming. Jesus also told a story about another master who left a manager in charge of his household while he left and said, if that manager thinks that the master will be gone for a long time, he will get drunk and abuse the servants. But then if the master comes back unexpectedly, that manager will face severe punishment. So these same images of staying awake and being sober are used. This is how we live toward the day. I don't know about you, but I love falling asleep. Isn't that a great moment in your day? Climb into bed, pull the covers up, it's warm and cozy. I usually lie on my back for a few minutes to kind of decompress, and then I curl over, curl up, go back to the womb, and fade off, you know. It's a great moment. Don't do it now, but you can anticipate it later. You're comfortable, everything else is faded away, and you can fall asleep. And we like to be comfortable. So much of our lives are lived trying to get comfortable. We want comfortable cars, we want comfortable jobs, we want comfortable lives, we want comfortable environments. Being comfortable means removing everything that could cause pain or suffering, getting rid of all the hard stuff and just being safe and cozy. That's what we want. When we're comfortable, we can fall asleep. So maybe staying awake has something to do with not focusing so much on getting comfortable for ourselves. Getting drunk is different. Getting drunk is about distracting yourself. It's about realizing that the things in my life and the things of this world are so complicated. They're so big. There's so much to worry about. I'm just going to find something else to spend my time on, find something to take my cares away, to focus on something else. Maybe it is actually drinking, but it could also be entertainment. It could be recreation, social activities. It could be work, achievement, professional development. We try to fill up every last gap in our lives so we don't have to actually think about what's really going on. And isn't this why people love the internet? Listen to some of these headlines I found. Can you solve these kids' riddles that stump the average adult? 14 reasons why first dates are exactly like job interviews. I like this one. Great news! A new study says you can shove your face with cheese to lose weight. You'd click on that, right? I found these on a website called distractify.com. This is what we do, right? We distract ourselves. But do we really need to see pictures of 21 pets taking full advantage of the glorious spring weather? Is that really going to help us in life? Maybe being sober has something to do with not always distracting ourselves. But the problem is, if we stay awake and if we are sober, we have to face the realities of life. And the realities of life are that there is a lot of hard stuff to deal with. There's hard stuff in our own lives. For some of us, it's buried really deep, but it is there, suffering and pain and confusion. There's hard stuff in the world. No matter where you look, people are suffering, people are hurting. It's way easier to go to bed or get drunk than to face the realities of this world. Staying awake and being sober means that we're willing to face into suffering. We're not afraid of it. We're not going to turn away from it. It means that we identify with suffering, our own and the suffering of the world. If you're facing something difficult in your own life, don't run away from it. Don't try to escape it. Ask God what he's doing. Share that suffering with somebody else. Ask for help. Work through it. If you're in a season of comfort right now, then you have a unique opportunity to help somebody else who's suffering, to engage with the pain in the world. It doesn't mean you need to feel bad that your life is okay or have guilt. It just means God's put you in a position where you can help. You can do something, no matter how small, to engage with the suffering of others. You can comfort someone else. This is what staying awake and being sober looks like, identifying with suffering. Have you ever tried to sit around for a long period of time and not fall asleep and not distract yourself? You might say, I'm doing that right now. It's hard, right? You're tempted to drift off, my nice melodious voice drifts you into comfortable sleep. Or you're tempted to distract yourself with something else. Because you can't just sit there. You have to do something, right? Well, that's why the apostle gives us something to do. He talks about this mission that we have. He uses military language to describe it. He says, we have put on body armor and a helmet. And the language he uses is quoted from Isaiah 59, which describes the Lord himself putting on this armor and this helmet, and the Lord going to battle against his enemies. But now the apostle says, Jesus has left, he is coming back, but in the meantime, we put on his armor. We go to fight the battles that God is fighting. And how do we do that? What are the three things we have at our disposal? It's the Christian virtues, faith, hope, and love. This is what Christians do. We believe, we hope, and we love. This is our calling. This is what we did last weekend when we went out into the community. We did our best to believe in Jesus, to hope for something better, and to love the people in our community. This is what we do when we worship together. We profess our belief and our hope, and we love each other. Everything we do as Christians is about integrating these three things into our lives. We believe in Jesus, we hope for his return, and we love others in the meantime. That's what we do. That's what the Christian armor is all about. This is what it looks like to live toward the day. We believe in a God who redeems, we hope for a king who returns, and we love those who remain. So the passage began by describing how some people would be surprised by Jesus' return. Went on to say, if you believe in Jesus, that doesn't describe you. You have the opportunity to live toward that day, to stay awake, to be sober in anticipation of that day. And the passage concludes by describing why you're able to do that. What is it that allows you the freedom to hope for the day? Listen to verses 9 through 11. For God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we might live with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing. We like stories about the end of the world. We talk a lot about how it might end. I read an article last week about on Earth Day suggesting that if the temperature of the Earth rose 2 degrees Celsius, then we would be facing some type of a global climate cataclysm. We have other stories about the end of the world as well. Maybe an asteroid is going to come and strike the Earth and destroy everything. Maybe a deadly disease will wipe us all out. Maybe computers will take over and we'll be answering Siri's questions. Maybe there'll be some kind of zombie apocalypse that will happen. We have all these stories about how it might happen. And I think what we're doing in those stories is we're playing out our own fears. We're teasing them out, exploring them. And they usually have to do with either some great event that's outside of our control happening to us, or something that we've done, choices that we have made that end up going bad and end up ruining it for us. Even the biblical stories are scary. We have this book at home called The Action Bible. That's a graphic novel version of the Bible, like a comic book. And one morning, one of our children came to us and said that he couldn't sleep that night and he had terrible nightmares all night. And we said, well, what were you doing before you went to sleep? And he said, I was reading Revelation in the Action Bible. And we thought, well, yeah, that would give me nightmares too. A comic strip version of Revelation, that's terrifying. And so we associate the end, we associate the future with fear. We're scared of it. We're worried about it. And so much of our life is lived in fear of the future, worried about what might come. But the apostle says here that we are not destined for wrath. We have nothing to fear. But that day for us will be a day of salvation. It will be a celebration, a reunion, a homecoming. We don't have to fear the future. We can look forward to the future. We embrace the future. Now, to be fair, there is a lot to be scared of in the future. There's a lot to be worried about, things that might happen. Jobs are lost, sickness invades, loved ones die, relationships shatter. As I've gotten older, if anything, I've become more afraid of the types of things that could happen. It seems like the stakes get raised as you get older. There's more to be afraid of. But what if we didn't have to be afraid? What if we knew how the story ended? What if we had confidence that what was waiting for us was a day of salvation? Wouldn't that change everything? I remember looking for a job the summer after I graduated from high school. And I was so stressed about finding a job. And I thought, if I don't find a job this summer, everything is lost. That would be the worst thing that could ever happen to anybody in the history of the world, is if I don't find a job. And of course, now I look back and think, well, that wouldn't have mattered all that much, actually. Those fears now seem insignificant compared to the things I worry about today. And I wonder if there will come a day when I look back at my fears now, at the things that consume my thoughts today, and think, those were actually so insignificant. But I don't wonder, I know that there will come that day. There will come a day of peace and security where all the fears and worries seem like they fade away. And whatever struggles we have will be seen as nothing compared to the glory that God will bring. When Jesus returns, we will live with him. It will be good. And because we know that's where our story ends, we don't have to fear what happens tomorrow. That long-term security gives us short-term peace. We don't have to worry about tomorrow because we know that next week is going to be okay. Whatever happens in the interim, whatever ups and downs we go through, we know the story resolves in peace. That's why Jesus said this in Matthew 6:34. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. And what he means by that is to say that he will take care of tomorrow. That tomorrow's tomorrow is life with Jesus. And in between, there's nothing to worry about. So I can embrace the future. And I can help you to embrace the future. We can help each other embrace the future. That's how the passage concludes. Encourage one another with these words. Comfort each other, not with warm beds and nice jobs, but with the news that Jesus is returning, and because of that, we're going to be okay. This is what Christians have been comforting each other with for centuries and millennia. No matter what's going on in their lives, they have repeated this refrain: Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. That is our hope. Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. Comfort each other with these words. Well, I did manage to surprise Rachel when I proposed to her for a split second, somewhat. She wasn't shocked, but I showed up without her knowing, and at the end of that day, we got engaged, and we set a date for the wedding, and we started planning. That's what you do. You plan towards something that you know is going to arrive. The problem we have, though, is that that day is out there. We don't know when it's going to arrive. How do we plan for something when we don't know when to expect it? That's the tension of living in between the times. That's the ambiguity we face. And it's no surprise that Christians over and over again over the last 2,000 years have tried to find that date, have tried to set the date so they can plan toward it. But every time they've tried, they've been wrong. We want to know, but we're called to live in anticipation of the day and not know when it's going to arrive. It's a tricky thing to do, but we are given help to do it. We are given some instruction. We are warned against hoping in something else, hoping for peace and security from a source that will not be able to deliver it. We know that only Jesus is worth hoping in. Because we hope for his return, we live toward that day. We orient ourselves. We don't comfort ourselves and fall asleep. We don't distract ourselves and forget about the world. We stay awake. We stay sober. We fight the fight that Jesus fought, that he's given us to do in his absence. And we identify with suffering in our lives and in the world. We can do all that because we're not afraid. We don't have to fear the future. We know there is something good waiting for us. We know that when Jesus returns, we will live with him. So we can embrace the future. And so we live toward that day. We will not be surprised, but we will welcome Jesus eagerly. We are children of that day. Let's live like it. Amen.